Well, we started looking at this great subject of the chastening of the Lord last week, and we saw how it was necessary for all of God's children, if we are his children, then he needs to prepare us for heaven. And it means that we have to give all to him and be prepared for his chastening. We have to see in everything that we do his hand, and everything that happens in our lives, we should see his hand in it. And we need to guard against that error of being those who are stiff upper lip, who just carry on regardless, don't take heed to think, is God teaching me something through this trial that I'm going through? And we all face trials, don't we? And Paul wrote in Acts chapter 14, through much tribulation do we enter the kingdom of heaven. And so we must make sure that we do not run from the Lord's chastening, and that we are willing instead to embrace it. And there are some dangers, aren't there, and some problems that with this whole issue of God's chastening and our reaction to it. The person who is going to be blessed is the person who recognizes and acknowledges God's correction and isn't, as I said, isn't stubborn like Saul. You know, instead of Saul in Acts chapter 9, verse 5, the Lord said, I am Jesus whom thou persecutest. It's hard for thee to kick against the pricks. So when God has sent in his judgments to Saul, he was resisting them. But in the end, of course, wonderfully, God saved him. We must make sure that we don't fall into that camp as well. And as we said last week, that we must make sure that we don't react. You know how dogs sometimes there are times when I've seen a dog, and I'm not sure whether I'd approve of it, but sometimes it's necessary to hit a dog, perhaps with a stick. If that dog is serious in its behavior, it's attacking another dog, that's the sort of time you will have to use a stick on it. You wouldn't do it lightly, and we don't do it regularly. But I have seen a situation, I think probably all have, when the dog will then turn on the stick and attack the stick. And there is an element in that for us, isn't it, that we will not consider who's behind the stick. You see, what a dog should do is consider, well, my master is behind, is wielding this stick. And so, therefore, we must obey my master, not attack the secondary cause. There's a wonderful verse in, I say a wonderful verse, it's a challenging verse in Amos chapter 3, verse 6. Shall a trumpet be blown in the city, and the people shall not be afraid? Shall there be evil in a city, and the Lord have not done it? Now consider that, apply that to London. Consider the evil that's been done in London. Think of those awful demonstrations flashing up the slogan from the river to the sea on Big Ben. Consider the one of the most wicked of murders, that of Sarah Everard a couple of years ago by that police officer, Mr. Cousins. Awful. And those who were at the receiving end, and the loved ones, many will say, well, how can a God of love allow this? But to understand this world properly, we must understand that even the most evil act have been done by the Lord. Now, that is not in any way to suggest that God is guilty, like Mr. Cousins is guilty. He is a sovereign, holy God. But everything that happens in this world is by his decree and for purposes of judgment. purposes of sending in his judgment, purposes of bringing about his per his for to fulfillment, to bring all his elect to Christ. These are hard things, aren't they? But there is another. You're either left with that, which I believe is the correct view. It's a biblical view. Amos chapter 3, verse 6 tells us. Or this idea that somehow this is a battle between good and evil. And sometimes good wins, sometimes evil wins. And the more powerful the devil gets, well, the more he wins and God loses. That is a perspective that is often mentioned in the church. But that would leave us all confused and scared and fearful as Christians. What would be the point of praying to a feeble God who isn't actually in control of Satan? But Satan doesn't do any of his bidding without God giving him permission. We know that from the book of Job. Anyway, going back to the irritation we can have of the rod, the irritation like that dog who attacked the stick. Remember Asa? He was angry with the seer and he put him in a prison house, for he was in a rage with him because of this thing. And Asa oppressed some of the people at the same time. And behold, the acts of Asa, first and last, lo, they're written in the book of the kings of Judah and Israel. So Asa ended his rule on a terrible note. The means God has sent to chasten him was rejected, and Asa failed to look behind the hand. He failed to say, is there evil in the city? And God have not sent it. Has he sent this messenger with this message to me? Should I not take heed? Well, many don't. Well, there is another extreme, isn't there? So this is the person who attacks the chastening of the Lord. Then there's the other extreme of fainting under the Lord's hand as being too heavy, like Psalm 73, verse 14. When the psalmist wrote, for all the day long have I been plagued and chastened every morning. So we are tempted in those circumstances where we are heavy under the burden of God's correction to think dishonorable thoughts about God, as Jacob did. And Jacob, their father, said unto them, me, this is to his children, me have ye bereaved of my children. Joseph is not, and Simeon is not, and ye will take Benjamin away. All these things are against me. Poor Jacob. It's no wonder he says, is it short and evil are my days, or something like that. He's obviously a man who was subject perhaps to depressions. And he couldn't see the bigger picture. We've got to be careful for ourselves not to miss the bigger picture, to faint under God's chastening and not to take a step back and see what God might be saying in it and what our end must be. And so we must avoid self-pity. Job wrote in Job chapter 6, verses 9 and 10, even that it would please God to destroy me, that he would let loose his hand and cut me off. Then should I yet have comfort? Yea, I would harden myself in sorrow. Let him not spare, for I have not concealed the words of the Holy One. Self-pity is a terrible plague, really, isn't it? And it does lead, unfortunately, to suicides, even amongst believers. And we heard of one, as I already mentioned, we have no idea what the cause was, but even Christians can get so depressed and full of self-pity that they actually commit the ultimate act of self-love, which is to commit suicide. And people don't always think of it like that, but it is really the ultimate act of self-love, isn't it? Because it is making a statement. It's sometimes trying to make, it's hurting those that most love you when you take your own life. If only people would think that before they take that ultimate step and leave behind the grief and sorrow and tragedy that follows in its wake. We must never give up our hope of heaven. Jeremiah 29, verse 11, for I know the thoughts that I think towards you, saith the Lord, thoughts of peace and not of evil, to give you an expected end. Otherwise, we're going to be weary of correction, weary of the way, because we've lost sight of the destination. Have you ever had that? Perhaps on a long journey, you lose sight of where you're going. And of course, the correct. I remember when I've had long walks in the past, just have to say, well, I've just got to just concentrate on the next step. And every time you take a step, you get closer to your destination. Or children who say, are we nearly there? Just round the next corner, you tell them. And of course, it's not the next corner or the next corner. But they can, little children can lose hope, can't they, that they're ever going to get to the end of the journey. So instead of despising God's chastening, we must reverence or even welcome it. And see it, dare I say it, as a privilege. Lamentations chapter 3, verses 28 to 29. He sitteth alone and keepeth silence because he hath borne it upon me. He putteth his mouth in the dust. If so be, there may be hope. And then Micah 7, verse 9. I will bear the indignation of the Lord because I have sinned against him until he plead my cause and execute judgment for me. He will bring me forth to the light, and I shall behold his righteousness. So instead of being weary of being corrected, we must humble ourselves, as Peter wrote in 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 6. Humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you in due time. And we should expect a richer blessing from sustaining grace through a trial than from the removal of the affliction. People who are sick, for example, they're always very quick to pray for healing. But God may be doing something through that sickness. I'm not saying we shouldn't pray for healing. And of course, we don't pray for God to keep, well, maybe sometimes we should pray that God would keep that affliction on whoever it is until that work is done. It just doesn't sound very loving. I think we should probably pray that about ourselves rather than others. 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verses 7 to 10. This is what Paul wrote about his thorn in the flesh. No one knows what it was, but it was that there was blind. He was going blind, or whether it was some physical or mental affliction. And lest I should be exalted above measure through the abundance of the revelations, there was given to me a thorn in the flesh, the messenger of Satan to buffet me, lest I should be exalted above measure. For this thing I besought the Lord thrice, that it might depart from me. And he said unto me, my grace is sufficient for thee. My strength is made perfect in weakness. Most gladly, therefore, will I rather glory in my infirmities, that the power of Christ may rest upon me. Therefore, I take pleasure in infirmities, in reproaches, in necessities, in persecutions, in distresses, for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then am I strong. I remember somebody who was ill and they had to go to court. The person was a Christian and they were ill and not feeling like it at all, but felt that they should trust the Lord. And so that person went to court and found remarkable providences on the way, could hardly put one foot in front of another at one point. Met a fellow believer at his own church at another. And then when he got to court, found that remarkably the case just disappeared. And at the end of the day, he had proved that my grace is sufficient for the weakness of that person. And isn't that, shouldn't that be all of our testimony? How many times, if we're just suffering from a minor illness, I can't do this. Obviously, if it's a question of perhaps passing on to other people, that's another consideration. But we can be too quick, can't we, to avoid testing the Lord through our affliction and saying, yes, his grace was sufficient for my need. In my weakness, there was my strength. I can do all things through Christ who strengthened me. That should be where we should be aiming, isn't it? And when we see God in the affliction, we'll see the benefits that have come. Perhaps as the author of the commentary I use, Charles Bridges, wrote, we were living too easy a life and too backslidden, and the affliction awoke us to a serious calling back to God's word and prayer. It's a wonderful thing when we can look at a discipline, a chastening, and accept that this was necessary for us. And so we read in Psalm 141, verse 5, let the righteous smite me, it shall be a kindness, and let him reprove me, it shall be an excellent oil, which shall not break my head, for yet my prayer also shall be in their calamities. Faith understands the reasons for discipline. Peter wrote, wherein in 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 6 and 7, wherein ye greatly rejoice, though now for a season, if need be, you are in heaviness through manifold temptations, that the trial of your faith, being much more precious than of gold that perisheth, though it be tried with fire, might be found unto praise and honour and glory at the appearing of Jesus Christ. And faith acknowledges trials as part of God's gracious providence. As Moses wrote in Deuteronomy chapter 8, verse 2, and thou shalt remember all the way which the Lord thy God led thee these 40 years in the wilderness to humble thee and to prove thee, to know what was in thine heart, whether thou wouldest keep his commandments or not, or no. It's also part of the provision, God's provision in the covenant of grace. Have you thought about that? You know, the tulip and the fifth part of the acronym, perseverance of the saints. Perseverance to the end. This is what we find in Psalm 89, verses 30 to 34. If his children forsake my law and walk not in my judgments, if they break my statutes and keep not my commandments, then will I visit their transgression with the rod and their iniquity with stripes. Nevertheless, my loving kindness will I not utterly take from him, nor suffer my faithfulness to fail. My covenant will I not break, nor alter the thing that is gone out of my lips. In other words, yes, I'll chasten them, but I won't take my love from them, and it'll be part of the work that is being done in their hearts to prepare them for heaven. So we're to wait to see the end of the Lord, as James wrote, behold, we count them happy which endure. You've heard of the patience of Job and have seen the end of the Lord, that the Lord is very pitiful and of tender mercy. And as has already been mentioned, of course, our main support that we draw is the seal that to see chastening as a seal of our adoption as God's sons. He corrects those he loves. It's like a family correction, not like a school correction, or much less prison. There's no caprice in God's punishment. He doesn't punish because he enjoys it, because he's just picking on you, because he doesn't like you. None of that. Jeremiah wrote in chapter 32, verse 41, yea, I will rejoice over them to do them good, and I will plant them, sorry, this is what the Lord said, yea, I will rejoice over them to do them good, and I will plant them in this land assuredly with my whole heart and with my whole soul. It's only correction for our improvement, and we can be sure that the Lord doesn't just choose the right means, but also the best time. Isaiah chapter 30, verse 18, and therefore will the Lord wait, that he may be gracious unto you, and therefore will he be exalted, that he may have mercy upon you, for the Lord is a God of judgment. Blessed are they that wait for him. And he will consider the most considerate measure and the most effective instruments I've already alluded to. And we find that in Lamentations chapter 3, verses 31 to 33. For the Lord will not cast off forever, but though he cause grief, yet will he have compassion according to the multitude of his mercies. For he doth not afflict willingly, nor grieve the children of men. And so often we get off very lightly, don't we, when we consider the wickedness of our sin and the lightness, the relative lightness of his correction. Ezra chapter 9, verse 13. And after all that has come upon us for our evil deeds and for our great trespass, seeing that thou, our God, hast punished us less than our iniquities deserve, and hast given us such deliverance as this. John Fletcher, who was an 18th century saint, he worked with John Wesley and the Methodists. He wrote, "I love the rod of my heavenly Father. How gentle are the stripes I feel, how heavy those I deserve. O God, I have made an ill use of thy mercies, if I have not learnt to be content with thy correction." Well, let's not be complainers, such as Rebecca at the birth, at the struggle of her two children in the womb. If it be so, why am I thus? There can be this temptation to complain to the Lord. O Lord, why me? Why have you sent this to me? The reality is that we are as we are because this is our Father's training discipline from heaven and for preparation for heaven. And it's because of his love for us. He loves us so much that he's willing to inflict pain on us, melt us in his furnace to stamp upon us his image. Well, let me just take one of these verses, Isaiah chapter 48, verse 10. "Behold, I have refined thee, but not with silver. I have chosen thee in the furnace of affliction." Perhaps just Malachi 3, verse 3 as well. "And he shall sit as a refiner and purifier of silver. And he shall purify the sons of Levi and purge them with gold and silver, that they may offer unto the Lord an offering in righteousness." You see, the purpose is that we should partake of his holiness. And in doing that, we partake of his happiness. I should say that these thoughts really are not terribly original, or not original to me, they are Charles Bridges. So let's do read his portion on this passage. But unless we enter in his mind, we will, as far as we can, defeat his purpose and lose the benefit. So we must enter into the mind of God when we face affliction. Jeremiah chapter 6, verse 8. "Be thou instructed, O Jerusalem, lest my soul depart from thee, lest I make thee desolate, a land not inhabited." That is the alternative if we ignore, if we fail to look into the reasons for his chastisements. And we should look well into the dispensation that God has sent to us at this time. Just take one of these verses, Lamentations chapter 3, verse 40. "Let us search and try our ways and turn again to the Lord." I've already mentioned this general point about the Lord, the messenger that God sends. It's the rod of his affliction. And he will not tolerate his messenger being despised, as Asa despised the prophet. We should instead be anxious to hear the rod, hear what it is saying, and who is wielding it, who have appointed it. Micah chapter 6, verse 9, "The Lord's voice crieth unto the city, and the man of wisdom shall see thy name. Hear ye the rod, and who hath appointed it?" We should know that the Lord have not done without cause all that he have done. We should be more concerned to have the affliction sanctified to us rather than removed. In fact, we should deplore its removal until it's performed its appointed work. Isaiah chapter 4, verse 4, "When the Lord shall have washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion, and shall have purged the blood of Jerusalem from the midst thereof by the spirit of judgment and by the spirit of burning." Let's make sure that our sin, as it were, has been purged before the affliction is lifted. So we should instead admire the God's considerate dispensation towards us, using these light afflictions as the means of delivering us from deadly evil. But that is what evil is, isn't it? It is deadly. If flesh and blood rebel, should the earthly tabernacle shake with the blow of his hand, Yet we will bless him throughout eternity, even by his crushing disciple, the Lord, by his crushing discipline, the Lord should accomplish his most merciful purpose. Thus wrote Charles Bridges. So we must give him unlimited confidence in what he is doing. And if some of the steps that we take are hidden, well, let's wait and see the end. This is what Job wrote in Job chapter 23, verses 8 to 10. Behold, I go forward, but he's not there, and backward, but I cannot perceive him. On the left hand, where he doth work, but I cannot behold him. He hideth himself on the right, but I cannot see him. But he knoweth the way that I take. When he hath tried me, I shall come forth as gold. So let us watch again from Bridges for the first whispers of his will, the first intimation of his providence, his guiding eye. Let's look for it. What is he doing in this providence? We'll save ourselves any strokes when we take the chastisement with peace and quietness. It should lead us to study, to prayer, to inward reflection. Again, as Charles Bridges wrote, no communion is closer, more endearing, more fruitful as that with a God who disciplines. Never is Christ more precious to us, or his love more. I can't read that. Let me just see if I can find out what I said. Sorry. His love never more sweet. That was the missing word. No communion is closer, more enduring, more fruitful as that with a God who disciplines. Never is Christ more precious to us or his love more sweet than in the midst of chastening. Never have we so full a manifestation of the divine character and perfections. And we'll sing from Psalm 119, verse 75, shortly. So what we know in practice, we put into practice. What is Christianity without the experience of it? You can read all the books you like about Puritans. You can fill yourselves with doctrine. But if it's not your experience, you can't own it, can you? It's always what somebody else went through, not what you went through. Well, finally, again, from quoting from Charles Bridges, with regard to the full weight and duration of the trial and all its circumstances, successively to bitter and piercing, we may ask which of them would be spared. It is quite clear as to the whole time, the whole weight, the whole number and variety of circumstances, that all and each were as necessary as any part. Where could we have stopped without making that stop fatal to the great end? What does it all mean but the Lord, holding to his determination to save us, all the thoughts of his heart, every exercise of his power, centering in his purpose of his sovereign mercy? Look back, some of the chastenings that you've had. I can remember one when I had a particular army job and I decided that I wasn't going to serve the Lord. Could you believe it? During that time, I'd given myself to worldly pleasure. It ended badly. And as I left early from that job, the reading for the day was Romans chapter 8, verse 28. All things work together for good, for them that love God and are called according to his purpose. I had sinned. I deserved what I got. And it taught me a lesson. May the Lord teach us lessons through the various trials and afflictions that he sends to us. And let's not be hard-hearted. Let's not try and push those afflictions away, but let us be willing, like an unpleasant medicine that we know is going to heal us, Let us be willing to swallow it and remember the end. The end is the Lord Jesus Christ, isn't it? And so going back to the passage in Hebrews chapter 12, wherefore, seeing we are also compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which doth so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God, looking unto Jesus, remembering he is the way and he is the end. Amen.
Thank you.